It's 8:06 on this Tuesday, June 2nd. Let's see, currently we've got 50 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 54 degrees in the Heber Valley under mostly sunny skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Tuesday. And we are looking at mostly sunny to partly sunny skies. A few clouds this morning, more sunshine as we go throughout the day. Temperatures, another warm day heading our way. Highs will climb into the mid-70s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 80s. In the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Wednesday, look for mostly sunny skies. We're going to start to really warm it up. We're talking high temperatures approaching 80 degrees in Park City as we go throughout the afternoon. The Heber Valley, we're looking at high temperatures climbing into the mid-80s. As we go into your Thursday, we'll see lots of sunshine, a few thin clouds out there still left over. High temperatures will still be in the upper 70s to near 80 in Park City with highs in the mid-80s still for us in the Heber Valley. We'll be in the mid to upper 80s for highs by the time we get towards your Friday in the Heber Valley, with high temperatures climbing into the upper 70s in Park City. Now, as we go into your weekend, it's going to be warm to start, with Saturday featuring mostly sunny skies. We'll have those temperatures into the mid to upper 70s for highs. Once again, in Park City, we'll have those highs in the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. A storm system will move by, but very much to our north into Canada as we go into your Saturday night into Sunday. Now, that's not going to do a lot for us in terms of any precipitation, but what it will do is it will shift the winds and also increase the winds, and that's going to lead to an elevated fire danger threat heading into the weekend. But also, as that system moves by, it will try to send in a little cooler air. So we'll see those high temperatures dropping from the mid to upper 70s in Park City on your Saturday to highs only around 70 as we get into your Sunday. Now, the Heber Valley will go from temperatures into the upper 80s to near 90 on Saturday to high temperatures only into the low 80s by the time we get towards your Sunday. And we'll pretty much hold there heading into the beginning of next week with highs near 70 in Park City and highs near 80 in the Heber Valley. As I look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back, I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. In a few minutes, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes, taking a look at some development projects throughout the county. Later on, Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow will preview Wednesday's County Council meeting. And finally, the Executive Director of Utah Open Lands, Wendy Fisher, in to talk about a number of open space issues that they're working with, as well as their upcoming fundraiser. Well, an effort by a few Heber City residents to undo the controversial North Village annexation cannot go forward. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the state appeals court ruled the residents missed the deadline to apply for the referendum.
A small group of Heber City residents filed a referendum petition in January 2025, seeking to undo the council's decision to annex 95 acres in the North Village. The city denied their application because the annexation was approved in December 2024, and residents must seek a referendum within 5 days. However, the residents argued the 5-day clock should have begun later because the annexation was contingent upon the council approving two master development agreements in January 2025. In a ruling Friday, the Utah Court of Appeals disagreed. Judges said they were not unsympathetic, but the residents missed their deadline. The appellate ruling confirms the judgment of 4th District Judge Jennifer Mabee, who ruled in favor of the city in July 2025. City spokesperson Ryan Bunnell says Heber staff welcome the ruling.
It's our desire at Heber City Corporation to follow the law. You know, this is important for a government entity, and that shows respect to all citizens and process.
The North Village was zoned for mixed-use development by the county before the land was annexed into Heber City. It will include two large developments, The Slope, previously known as Harvest Village, and The Crossings. The Slope broke ground in April, southwest of the intersection of U.S. 40 and River Road. Heber City resident and former mayoral candidate Mike Hewlett filed a separate lawsuit against the city in June 2025. He argues the city was wrong to reject his application for a referendum to undo the creation of two public infrastructure districts in the North Village. The next hearing in the case is June 29th. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from the Summit County Planning Office, it's Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Leslie. Glad to be with you from sunny Colville, as ever.
Thank you. I guess we always like to start. Any new major applications that have come through the door?
Nothing that should excite the public at large. This time of year, we get the warm weather sets in and people, rush to the fore. What we've had in the last week, for example, is more than a handful of what we call low-impact permits. These tend to be residential applications for projects that might appear on a relatively steep slope or potentially affecting ridgeline, or even a home that's outside a platted subdivision. They're required to go through the additional low-impact permit process where we get generally a cursory review from the planning department to make sure they meet all the relevant codes. But nothing that the general public should get too excited about, I don't believe.
Okay. Was going to ask a little bit about what's the latest with Klein Dolly. I know that this is coming up before the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, June 9th.
This is interesting because it's not actually the what's triggered it was the Klein Dolly project. What's actually being brought on June 9th in front of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission is the process whereby we amend the zone district. If you're looking to amend a zone, apply for a rezone, for example, from rural residential to community commercial or any of our other zones, the applicant is required to go through a fairly onerous process. It's not just rigorous like it should be, but it's actually incredibly expensive and very high risk. It requires the production of construction level documents way early in the process, which shifts a massive amount of the financial burden up front and a big risk, because typically as a project goes through the later approval processes, things are changed, and that requires a wholesale redraw and a waste of resources, waste of time, waste of money. So what we're doing on next Tuesday is essentially adjusting that process to provide not the construction level type information, but a proof of concept type information, a type of diagram with enough information that demonstrates the volumetrics, the massing, the infrastructure layout without requiring permit ready drawings. It just requires the proof of concept. Can the project as proposed fit on the site, and can it demonstrate that it will likely meet the codes as it will be conditioned in the future? And that shifts the burden. The trigger for this was essentially the Klein Dolly project, but this would actually be a process that would apply for anybody who is applying for a rezone. Following this, there will be specifically for Klein Dolly a creation of a new zone, a code text amendment that actually creates a new zone. That will follow, and that will probably be a longer process, probably a lot more interest to the public at large than the administrative side of how we actually go about applying for it. This might be interesting because it has a mirror on the east side, and that's the Browns Canyon Lost Creek Community Zone, which is actually the similar process where they're actually applying for a text amendment in order to allow for the creation of the zone, and then the zone will follow. So a little bit geeky in terms of process rather than product. But for anyone who's interested, on June 9th, Snyderville Basin Planning will be looking at that process. The staff report will probably be published later this week, if not Wednesday or Thursday, I believe.
Okay. Well, so how far along is the planning department with these rezones for Klein Dolly and Lost Creek?
The Klein Dolly one, part of the problem we've had, we've done a lot less design review than we would like, because the applicant, which is essentially a partnership between the county council and representatives, and the product that the developer was chosen through the RFP process, we've reached this kind of stalemate where the developer says he's exhausted his level of commitment without some return commitment on the county side that if he puts more money on the table, et cetera, in terms of interest in developing drawings, going into some details, that there is actually a commitment to create the project. And that's one of the reasons why we've come up against this halt. The negotiation on what will actually occur on the property and how responsibilities are shared has been ongoing. That's outside the design side of it that takes us, you know, through that very exciting stage. So we haven't actually had a revised site plan sketch layout since last October. As soon as we get this process in place, we have the joint venture agreement signed, I believe, and consequently the developer can put a lot more resources into creating the information that we're going to need to take it to the next level of design. One of the critical issues is infrastructure and engineering standards, and our engineering department are currently going through their own code amendments. So what we want to make sure is we don't accidentally create a zone that puts us into immediate conflict with the new engineering standards, and that would be things like road widths, lengths, block lengths, snow storage facilities, etc. We want to make sure that in approving something on the planning side and with the developers with the developer side on this project, that we don't suddenly find a conflict that the engineering department are trying to go another way. So a little bit of internal wrestling. It's not a problem at the moment. We just need to develop more information before anyone will see anything worthwhile.
Okay. Also on the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission agenda, June 9th will be a work session for the Canyons Development Agreement, looking for an amendment regarding Red Pine Road. What's being asked here?
So the Red Pine Road, the Red Pine Road snakes up the mountain to the Red Pine area, which would be, you know, Red Pine Village, the future home, and the ongoing. So pre-approved density and development standards, you know, at the upper reaches of the canyons. The development agreement that originally approved that allowed for the creation of a road which would provide service access, construction access, etc. Specifically did was prohibit private use vehicles from accessing that road. The developer has actually been in front of the Planning Commission for two work sessions now, looking for an amendment to the development agreement that moves that restriction on private use vehicles. The argument that's being placed on the table, and it's a good argument, not 100% convinced, it's a good argument, and that the fire district, of course, is if I have occupied buildings at the top of the mountain, if I have hotels, condos, residential units, and there is an emergency situation, then if there's a need for evacuation, then clearly private use vehicles driving down that road is a good idea. So in anticipation of that, if we're going to allow private use vehicles to provide an evacuation process, why wouldn't they be allowed an access in the other direction? So the developer for the project is actually asking for an amendment that removes that restriction on private use vehicles. The Planning Commission has been a little bit skeptical as to what the alternatives are, because how do we prevent that road becoming a busy traffic road snaking up and down the mountain, which no one really wants to see. So traffic management solutions will be something that they're probably looking for. The developer has actually just come back to us since the last work session and just said, can we just go ahead with a public hearing, possible action, please?
Okay.
And move this to council.
As I recall, there is still a bunch more development that is slated for that Red Pine area. I mean, maybe as much as twice as what as much as what we see at the base. Or can you put any numbers on that?
I would love to do that. I'd hate to be horribly wrong, which I could be, but it's probably, you know, a million square feet plus of development, and typically similar to the type of development that you have down at the lower reaches of the canyon. So hotel, commercial type development at the top of the mountain. So imagine hotels, condo project at the top of the mountain. So it's a significant amount. It's pre-approved in the development agreement. They have their vested rights in order to develop. The question is now, how do we go about building it if that's what they want to do? And clearly, the creation of the road. The road's going to have to be built anyway. There's going to be a fire. It's going to be built to current county engineering standards for a fully serviced fire road. So if the road's there, if the road's constructed, the developer's saying, well, why shouldn't the people who occupy hotel rooms or homes up there, why wouldn't they be allowed to use the road to access it as opposed to take a gondola up the mountain? So that's the current debate. But yes, there is a significant amount of development already pre-approved under the existing agreement.
Yeah. Okay, moving on Wednesday, there'll be a short-term rental discussion at the county council meeting. One of your code enforcement team members will be presenting an update. Can you preview that a bit for us?
I'd like to. For a while now, the county have had an internal working group on short-term rentals. Short-term rentals, nightly rentals. They cause a lot of excitement in the community. You know, people want them. People don't want them. They all want one, but not one next door. So there's a lot of back and forth. We get complaints in our code enforcement, which is, you know, one of the triggers that that created the short-term rental working group. And it's like, do we need to put additional controls on these rentals? For a safety, I just mentioned fire, for example. There are areas of Summit County where access is difficult, especially in winter, where people aren't familiar with the area. They might be in a high-risk fire area, whether it's a wildland-urban interface type fire risk, where it's just snow and difficult conditions, winding roads. Do we want to put additional controls on short-term rentals? What would those controls look like? So part of Wednesday's discussion, Scott Buchanan from our code enforcement team, they actually adopted about a year ago a new code enforcement program where complaints can be handled via this telephone answering service, and complaints are dealt with by this third-party organization in its initial phases. But one of the things that this software program brings to the table is that they scout the web and look for advertised short-term rentals. We can compare that list with the short-term rental licenses that we've issued and see if there are any discrepancies. So if there are properties that are being advertised for rent that don't actually have business licenses, then we can actually follow up with initial inquiry letters. You know, we believe you're renting your property, you need to get a business license at the very least. And following up from that, there may be certain conditions applied. The Scott, after several months, if not a year of collecting this information, Scott will be going to the council with Malena Stevens, from the clerk's office, and Linda Vitti from the lawyer's office, to discuss the data that we've collected so far, the types of complaints we've received, the number of outstanding, nightly rentals that we believe are unlicensed, those that we're following up with, those that are waiting for licenses. So it's fairly complicated, but that Scott and the team do a really good job of presenting the information, and the policy conversation following from that is knowing what the current issue is. Are there any additional restrictions you'd like to propose now or in the future, and what would we base those on?
All right.
So that's Wednesday's conversation. I think it's 5 o'clock for the agenda on council.
And speaking of short-term rentals, a homeowner in Silver Creek Estates took Summit County to court over his nightly rental compound, which is what he calls it. The county wanted to shut it down because it was an event center, but Third District Court overturned that in April. Specifically, the ruling said that the man can rent the 7,000 square foot home as a short-term rental, but he can't let renters use the adjacent horse barn or entertainment facility with the basketball and pickleball courts. So, I mean, what do you make of that result?
It's kind of interesting, and I need to be a little bit careful here because there's been a sequence of legal actions going backwards and forwards. The latest decision by the judge, actually, recently as last week, I actually issued an amendment to the original conditional use permit. The original conditional use permit, which was for the 24,900 square foot, shall we call it an accessory building, which if, you know, the worst case scenario is people look at that as a party barn, and was causing some significant complaints, you know, the owner of the property in question would go, you know, that's his, you know, private sports court, and it's, you know, and that's not to be considered. The judge actually said that, the original conditional use permit only had two conditions in it. One of the conditions was that no structure on that parcel should be used for nightly rentals. And the other one was that no structure should be used for commercial purposes. The judge actually made the decision that the nightly rental restriction was not a requirement of the Planning Commission at the time they made their decision, and therefore that condition should be struck from the conditional use permit. So I actually issued a modified version of that conditional use permit doing exactly that, following that judge's decision, and just struck that condition out. The second condition, that no structure should be used for commercial purposes, was left untouched by the judge, is what I understand the situation to be, and I'm happy to be corrected by my legal department in about 15 minutes. The latest position that I believe is that the owner of the property has actually asked the judge to reconsider the decision. So I kind of think it's half and half. I thought our original position was that the operation as an event center had been shut down, but the operation as a nightly rental home is allowed, but the accessory building cannot be used for any kind of commercial purposes, therefore it should not be part of any form of nightly rental or any event venue. So I don't know if there's still a dispute between the county and the property owner, but I understand that the property owner has asked the judge to take another look at the decision.
Okay, I guess it's just that seems to me, how would you even know whether or not renters are using the court facility in Horse Arena?
That's a good question. It is part of our code enforcement problem that we face. And as you know, that the bulk of our code enforcement is dealt with on a complaints-based basis. I know the owner of this property would be of the opinion that he has neighbors who complain at the slightest noise, light, or car driving onto the property, and that's something we may or may not follow up on and take action or not. But part of the short-term rental conversation that we're going to be having at council might actually be looking to address situations like this in the future on a more general basis. This specific one, I'm sure we're not out of the woods yet in terms of everybody being satisfied. Everybody being a little bit unhappy might be the best we actually do on this one.
Yeah. And I guess real quick, I mean, do you feel like property owners are trying to get around those restrictions on commercializing their horse barns or other outbuildings just by renting out their house?
I like to think better of people than perhaps some are. I don't, if there is something, if what we describe as a loophole in the code, that's not getting around a problem. If the code is wrong, we need to fix the code. Are people out there doing things that they should not be doing? Absolutely they are. I wouldn't say it's true in any particular case without doing a significant amount of investigation first. Our code enforcement team do a really great job of contacting people against whom we receive complaints, and that includes these potential illegal rentals or activity centers, for want of a better word. And generally speaking, upon first point of contact, very many of the people actually immediately apologize and apply for the correct permits and go through the process. Unfortunately, some don't. And they're the ones that take up the bulk of our time.
Okay. I got to leave it there. Peter, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Bye now.
Peter Barnes serves as Summit County's Community Development Director. Well, on the phone now with a preview of tomorrow's Wasatch County Council meeting, I have County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin. Dustin, first Council will get an update from Intermountain Health. It looks like they'll be providing stats and a community report, not really anything to do with a development request or expanding the hospital or anything like that.
No, this is a regular annual report where the Intermountain Hospital presents kind of the charitable efforts that they're making.
Okay. Planner Doug Smith will be recognizing developers in Wasatch County who have made significant contributions to the county trail systems. I mean, what are we talking about significant here?
So Wasatch County normally requires trails when a development goes into, you know, the community. But some developments, they build a lot more than what is required. So we are going through the process to recognize those people who have gone above and beyond.
Okay. And are trail connections with the development happening? I mean, or do we have trails out there to nowhere?
I mean, there are trails that don't connect to other systems, but where there are connections that are possible, we make those. And we actually have funded grants through our TAP tax to be able to help close some gaps.
Okay. Also, the council will consider Ordinance 2609 that amends the county code to establish engineering exceptions. Why is this needed?
Right now, we have an engineering process that is very rigid. So even when there is a development that comes through and we mutually agree that maybe a deviation from some existing standards is beneficial for everyone, our current code doesn't allow us to grant those exemptions. So what this would do is the development exception process would just give us more flexibility.
The council will consider an ordinance amending and updating certain procedures and fees for grammar requests. So what will this amendment do specifically?
Yeah, so this is the second reading of an ordinance in which we are looking at making this change. Last year, we hired a specific position to process grammar requests. And what this does is kind of memorializes some of those changes. So previously, we were collecting grammars through both our clerk auditor's office and our sheriff's office. And now in the attorney's office, we'll have this single position that will be the main point of contact for all of our grammar requests and coordinate those responses to make sure that we are, you know, following the whole process and trying to be as proactive about these public information requests as possible.
Yeah, it looks like you're also hoping to increase fees.
Yeah, that is part of it. Previously, we were charging only, you know, for those requests that require a significant amount of time, an amount that did not actually cover the cost of providing those services. And it's really a question of equity. So when there are minor requests that don't require significant time, we don't charge anything. But sometimes there are requests that take many hours, and we feel like we want to balance the competing interests of general taxpayers subsidizing these information requests, or if the requester who is requesting kind of a voluminous amount of information, that they bear that cost.
Let's see, the council will also get an update on the Corridor Preservation Fund. Council has been collecting the vehicle registration fee associated with the local highway and transportation Corridor Preservation Fund since 2006, so for 20 years. How much has been raised?
It's been, I think, about $3 million over the life of that. This is a fee that goes on vehicle registrations in Wasatch County.
And how much has been spent, and how has it been spent?
So the majority of the funds have been used for corridor preservation, specifically on what is now the Heber Valley EIS, the Heber Valley Corridor Project. Previously, it was a Wasatch County and Heber City project. And we've used the majority of those funds to reimburse land purchases through that corridor. We have, I'm going to say, somewhere in the range of $500,000 that are still available. And this is part of the discussion that we're going to have with the county council about if we should keep the fee in place as we identify additional corridors through what is required in state code, the Council of Governments, or if we should consider rescinding that fee.
Yeah, and given the changes to that corridor alignment, is some of the land purchase kind of worthless at this point? I mean, land is certainly valuable, but I mean, in terms of what it was purchased for.
So I think there are segments where there are deviations from what were expected, but those are primarily the Heber City pieces that are kind of south of Highway 113 or Midway Lane. Heber City actually got those through an annexation process. So my understanding is I don't think they actually paid for those lands. The portions that the county purchased, we are using. And so this will be segments that extend north of 113 or Midway Lane.
All right. In other business, you're looking for direction from the council about preliminary municipalities and legislative engagement. It sounds like two different things here.
So last time we met, the council actually wanted to do some legislative engagement on preliminary municipalities. So this is kind of in response to that request. Generally, we are looking to share some high-level information about what preliminary municipalities are, what the process is that they use to go through, where the status of our current preliminary municipalities are, and how we might be able to engage the state legislature to express some of the concerns that we have with the process.
Hmm. And I believe the state allows three of these preliminary municipalities to happen a year. And that happens like January 2nd, you know, at midnight. I think Wasatch County ended up getting two of those this year. So now what?
Yeah, so there are two. One of them is the Wasatch Highlands that is located kind of on the north and east side of Heber City. And the other is Bear Canyon that, as of last I've heard from the Lieutenant Governor's office, was amending their application. This is kind of south in Provo Canyon off of 189 as you go into Utah County.
All right. And these, again, would be separate municipalities?
That's the concept, is that they are on a path towards incorporation. Some of the concerns the county has, though, is that there is an off-ramp where if they just decide that they're not going to incorporate or fail in that process, that becomes the burden of the county and potentially the burden of our taxpayers.
All right. So what are some of the other concerns?
I think generally it's a concern with the land use approval process. All local governments exist to try and balance competing interests in property rights, right? We set level playing field of, you know, what your neighbor can do and what you can do, and what you do affects them and what they do affects you. And so normally we have a balanced approach where we have elected officials who set rules and try and establish standards. And what this process does is it usurps that normal balancing, where three or fewer property owners can just decide for themselves that regardless of the impacts to their neighbors, this is what they're going to do.
Yeah, I think we had something similar, right? I mean, years ago, that's what a result of Hideout and Independence. And
yeah, well, it's a little different from a normal incorporation process. And that's what happened in those cases, in that there were existing residents who lived in that area. Now, I do believe there was a change to the process of incorporation, but it still required those people who already lived within that area to approve it. And there was a threshold that they had to meet. This preliminary municipality, they have zero residents. There are no people. It's just a landowner who gets to decide for their own. You know, you can imagine what it would be like if your next door neighbor decided, okay, well, I'm going to allow myself to build a skyscraper here, right? Mm-hmm. Or a high impact sports facility, I think is an example I've used in the past of. There are lots of impacts that from these types of decisions that we think need a fair and balanced approach as we make those types of decisions.
Yeah, so prior to any legislative changes happening, I'm guessing that these preliminary municipalities can go as the law was written. I mean, they're kind of grandfathered.
Yeah, I think that they have the same process that the previous preliminary municipalities are using. I think we still have some concerns with it, and I think we hope that it's a long process. And so I think if there were changes to it, it still has the possibility of impacting these projects.
Okay. Finally, wanted to note that there'll be a briefing on first quarter financial report. Everything looking good?
Yeah, the county's in a strong position. Our sales tax continues to be up. Some of our other revenue sources are still growing. They're kind of in single digit ranges where, you know, early in COVID era, we were seeing much larger increases, but we're still in a strong financial position. We expect to be able to continue to stay within our budget and stay within our means.
Okay, so the budget hasn't necessarily been impacted by inflation or higher prices, especially gas?
Those are the things that we kind of accounted for through our normal budgeting process. There are a few tweaks that we've already talked about with the council. I mean, we're halfway through the year. Some of the bigger changes are that we are authorizing some improvements to our jail. That would be outside of what our existing budget is, but we've presented to the council about that, and they're kind of deal with some health and safety issues in the jail.
Okay. Destin, anything else you wanted to add?
No, I don't think not this morning.
All right. Thanks for your time this morning. In the studio now with an update from Utah Open Lands, I have Executive Director Wendy Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the Bonanza Flat Conservation Area and the trail status there. I know there's some closures as well.
Yeah. I think that obviously we're all concerned about and suffering through the drought that we have. It has huge implications for us as a state. But I think one of the things that a lot of people aren't aware of is some of these areas that typically would have snow and would be just melting off at this point, they've been dry and they haven't had water for a while. But that doesn't mean that it has changed the rhythms of the elk and the moose and the deer. And so what we think is really important is for folks to respect these trail closures, which really are put in place to ensure that, you know, the mama elk and the baby elk are pretty secure and we're not bothering them. It can have real consequences if you disrupt that process and obviously the nesting of birds and whatnot. So the Bonanza Loop Trail is actually closed until July 1st because that is in the wildlife consideration area of the backcountry portion of Bonanza Flat Conservation Area.
Now, what about the other, the WOW trails?
Yeah, so our great partners over there at Wasatch Trails Foundation, they have completed some trails, but those, when you get to the Bonanza Loop Trail, which obviously is a connector for WOW, that again is closed until July 1st.
All right, I mean, are there barriers so that people just stay away?
There are signs and there's some rope showing that it's a closed area. And then, of course, working with Park City and the great group at Park City Transit, that purple line really won't start going up into Bonanza until right around the July 1st.
Yeah. All right. Utah Open Lands also received a Wasatch Front Transit to Trails grant. What's this?
So we have been really working forward on trying to mimic the pilot program that we started with Park City, I don't know, it was 6 years ago now, to ensure getting people from the Wasatch Front, instead of driving their vehicles up to Bonanza Flat Conservation Area, to have a shuttle service for them as well. So we have a pending grant with the Central Wasatch Foundation, which we're really excited about that, the commission. I know they're making a decision here pretty quick. But we also received funding from Salt Lake City and then also from the town of Brighton to help us create that concierge service of a free shuttle that will come up from the Wasatch Front. So we're trying to pilot that same idea. Again, when you think about sustainability and you think about even issues like climate change in our airshed, right? To have the ability to have people get into a shuttle and come up and, you know, be able to stop right at Bloods Lake, we think that's really, really going to be an outstanding moment.
So there would be some kind of collection area, maybe at one of the park and rides there off of Wasatch Boulevard?
Yeah, we're looking at a couple of different park and rides, working with our partners to make sure that we pick the right one. And then similar to what we were able to pilot here on the Wasatch back with Transit to Trails, people will be able to actually reserve their spot, get on the shuttle, and then come up to, you know, Bonanza Flat Conservation Area. I will say that because they're coming through Big Cottonwood Canyon, dogs will not be allowed.
Okay, and again, this is a free ride.
This is a completely free ride. Do something for yourself, do something for the planet.
Yeah, and how many shuttles do you anticipate that you would be able to offer each? You know, it would be kind of a Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing?
Yes, it's going to be basically Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The shuttles are going to be running basically every hour to 90 minutes going up and down there. And we haven't entered into the contract yet with the shuttle provider. We are planning to have this work July 1st, so I can't say who we're working with at this point. But it's really just a great program that we hope, similar to what's happened here in Park City, that this really catches on and that people say, yeah, this kind of transit solution makes sense.
All right, let's see. The Lundin Conservation Easement back on the Midway City Council agenda. Is this a go?
That's the big question. I think that where we're at is Wasatch County and Midway City, they have been absolutely in support of this. It's always the fine details and the complexity of these projects. Even with the support of Midway City and Wasatch County, Utah Open Lands will still need to raise about $4.5 million to make this happen. But because of the family dynamics, we need to take this first step. So actually, I'm headed to a meeting this morning to hopefully make sure that that can stay on the agenda. But stay tuned because it may not be able to get there today.
Yeah. I mean, what are some of the final outstanding issues that you need to deal with?
Well, as you can imagine, working through a conservation easement and then working through any sort of federal process, some of the issues are, one, ensuring that for the Midway City part, there was a piece of the Probst Ditch that's going to allow for some public access. That has a lot of elements of how do you create that public access and also allow for the continued livestock use of the property, which is key not only to other funding, but obviously to what the family wants to continue to do. And then it's also been working through the different family members. Not all of them have been on board with wanting to do this. So that has taken a lot of time, and actually there's even been some lawsuits that have been involved in that from the family side. So there's just, this is never easy to get these conservation easements done. The easy option is always actually just to sell to a developer. And so to have a family that has a love of the land, being willing to be patient and to work through this, I have to commend, you know, all sides of the family for staying at the table.
I'm going to say this is one of your more difficult ones.
Yes, this has been a challenging one. And I think that for Utah Open Lands, what has been challenging in part has been a couple of curveballs that have been thrown in, whether it was, you know, a lawsuit that popped up or something like that to really move this forward. And also paving the way to find the funding for it has been a challenge as well.
Yeah, how much time would you have to raise $4.5 million?
We would have 3 years, and of course, one of the things that we've got right now with our broader Heartland of the Heber Valley campaign is a $2 million challenge grant that we are hoping that we are able to match that by the end of this year. We have about $700,000 towards that $2 million match, but some of those funds could be used for the Lundin Farms conservation easement, among other projects like the Heart of Midway and some of the other projects, Pear Tree Llama Farm, that we've been working on as well. So really, that's what we're focused on right now, is the $2 million challenge grant that can hopefully open up the doors to be able to raise the funds that are needed for these conservation easements.
All right. If you were a betting person, though, back to the Lundin Conservation, I mean, is this a go?
I believe I'm like 99% there. Okay, now I am an optimist, but at the same time, the way that Wasatch County and Midway City and the Lundin family have stayed at the table to talk through these details that are never easy, making sure that what has been agreed to from Midway City's side, making sure that the public benefits are there, and then also making sure that the family can continue to farm this property into the future, and really that green field that you can see actually from all the way from 40 is something that's going to remain. Those things are incredible details to work through. It's really complex, and again, I commend everybody for staying at the table. And I believe because of the hard work that's been put into it, that this is going to happen.
Okay. Let's see, the Slate Canyon Preservation, this is property in Provo.
Yeah. So many folks will remember that we worked with, actually back in the day, Utah County to ensure that Bridal Veil Falls did not fall to development. That, I think, was a big shocker for everybody. And after we did the conservation easement, that actually was put forward as a monument, a state monument. So that has been permanently protected. But it really opened the eyes, I think, for some of the leaders and down in Provo and Utah County to say, hey, there are some of these other properties that comprise part of our watershed that are really important to see protected, and they are community resources that the community really wants to see protected. So actually, the Provo City worked with us on Bunnell's Fork. We did that last year. And then what we're working on right now is we are part of a memorandum of understanding with Provo City. We're going to have an open house at Slate Canyon on June 13th. And that's with the hopes that we're going to move forward with Provo City permanently protecting Slate Canyon from any development into the future. It's over 160 acres of land that is great hiking. I was down there the other day. It's just beautiful, beautiful piece of the state. And I think that that's what we're seeing, right? We have less and less of these open spaces left. So for Provo City and the leadership of Provo City to say, hey, let's ensure that this is protected for future generations, and that, you know, the development that is coming to the area doesn't affect Slate Canyon. This is really a legacy move.
So is that just off of 189 Provo Canyon Highway?
No, it's a little bit closer down into, you know, really the heart of Provo. You basically go up Center Street. So it's an area that everybody from Brigham Young University folks are going up there to, you know, really the communities that live in and around the Provo City area.
Okay. Also coming up, you say you hope to announce the preservation of land on the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake in the coming months. Why is protecting shoreline of kind of a dead lake important?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. I think many people are aware, obviously, that with these droughts, we have issues with respect to restoring water to the Great Salt Lake. But what many people don't realize is that the Great Salt Lake is an incredibly important resource for one third of the North American bird species. As they're migrating back and forth between their different homes, they stop at the Great Salt Lake for, yes, you may call it a dead lake, but there's a lot of habitat there. And so you have everything from, you know, great American pelicans to avocets to black-necked stilts to ibises. And they're all dependent upon the ecology of that area. Plus, as we retain the wetlands and the ecology around the Great Salt Lake, it's really, really a vital value for the resource itself. Some of what can happen when you protect some of these places is to ensure that the wetlands are sustaining themselves. A lot of people are familiar with the invasive species Phragmites. That actually sucks a lot of water out through very innovative methods. The state has actually been able to turn that Phragmites back into salt marsh grass. So there's a lot of ways that we can do great things to preserve the shoreline that help with the ecology that, again, is really important for all of these migrating birds that we really enjoy, that without this resource, I think that just like some of the pollinators, and we're seeing their habitat loss, we lose those pollinators as well. We don't want to lose these bird species.
Yeah, so isn't the Great Salt Lake, though, already kind of protected? It's actually private land right up to the shoreline, huh?
There is a lot of private land actually right up to the shoreline. And we actually had been working on another project that is not going to move forward. I think, as many people may be aware, back in the day, I believe it was in the 70s, maybe the 80s, there was a Northwest Quadrant development sort of district that was created there that allows for a lot of storage facilities and other things adjacent to the lake. So we'd actually been working on another 200 acres. Doesn't look like that is going to come to fruition. So yeah, there is private land around there. And again, the more habitat that we can protect, the better off that is really going to be for the lake and for the bird species as well.
Yeah, and with the declining shoreline, I mean, with the property you have, I mean, it goes into the lake further and further?
Yeah. The hope is, obviously, that Mother Nature will cooperate. And the hope is that actually through conservation methods, we can see a return of the Great Salt Lake. But actually, I think those wetland areas are going to become more and more vital, even as we see a shrinking shoreline.
Yeah, so are the pumps still out there?
I don't know.
Rusted, I'm sure, by now.
Right.
And just real quick note that early bird tickets for your annual fundraiser went on sale yesterday.
Yes. So all of the great work that Utah Open Lands is trying to accomplish, the stewardship is 67,000 acres throughout the state, about 30,000 of that right here on the Wasatch Back. We need the funding to keep going. So get your tickets for August 15th. We're going to be holding our Portraits of Preservation at High Ute Ranch.
Okay. Wendy Fisher is the Executive Director of Utah Open Lands. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.